Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. It's our energy disaster anniversary special. Yes, years ending in 9 are often unhappy ones for consumers of energy and other citizens. The good news is that the producers and marketers of energy seem to do just fine, regardless of the disasters they cause downstream. So, if you're a big energy company stockholder, by all means stay tuned. I think you'll be amused to hear who's actually paying for those fat dividend checks you're receiving. Of course, you already know the answer, but I think you'll be amused to hear it again. If you're not a big stockholder, maybe you'd rather turn off the radio, switch the TV to your local petroleum broadcasting system station, and watch the Nature documentary, underwritten by ExxonMobil and Citizens for Clean Nuclear Energy. God, those baby seals are sure cute! Okay, everybody settled in? For those remaining, we'll hear the words of researcher and anti-nuclear activist Harvey Wasserman. And we'll hear the words and voice of journalist Greg Palast. For this is the 30th anniversary of the near meltdown and near nuclear holocaust at Three Mile Island, Pennsylvania. Okay, maybe holocaust is too strong a word. How about Chernobyl? Anyone remember that? Okay, we almost had Chernobyl, Pennsylvania Dutch style. Talk about chew fly pie in the sky when you die. It's also the 20th anniversary of the world's greatest oil tanker smash-up ecological disaster, the Exxon Valdez Nakba, brought to you by Exxon Corporation in cooperation with British Petroleum and in violation of about 14 federal maritime laws and numerous contractual obligations. Don't worry, we'll blame it all on the drunken captain and get off scot-free. I hope that's not an ethnic slur. So what if the captain was asleep below decks and another officer had command of the ship? Every assassination needs a lone gunman fall guy, so the drunk captain it is. These two stories have a lot in common, and a lot in common with the here and now. Here are five ways. 1. Both disasters were caused by large corporations. 2. Neither corporation was ever penalized in any significant way. 3. The ecosystem suffered serious and long-term disruption. 4. People died or had their lives ruined. 5. The government lied and lied and lied to the people, and in fact did much worse than merely lie. It constantly whitewashed the seriousness of the problem. For example, after the huge radiation leak at Three Mile Island, the government of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania closed down its state tumor registry. Remember 9/11? A very few days after two airplanes allegedly reduced three skyscrapers to a cloud of fine silt particles, the federal government's Environmental Protection Agency announced that the air in the neighborhood was again safe to breathe. This got the financial industry and the stock exchange back to full speed as soon as possible. As a result, hundreds of firefighters and other rescue workers, heroes, Bush and Giuliani called them, these people have died or are now dying of lung disease. Lung disease caused by the poisonous, highly caustic, highly alkaline air at what the government likes to call Ground Zero. Poisonous air that the government knew was there. Think any of these dying heroes is getting even free health care? In all three cases, the government did not serve and protect the people. It actively helped kill and maim the people in order to keep corporate profits as high as possible. This may have been exactly what the Founding Fathers intended, but is it what we, the real people, are going to continue to passively accept? Here's Greg Palast, interviewed by Dennis Bernstein.
It's been 20 years since the Exxon Valdez went aground in Alaska, devastating 1,200 miles or more of Alaska's pristine coastline with toxic oil. Quote, it also marks the 20th year of a lie, writes Greg Palast on gregpalast.com. Quote, lots of lies. Greg Palast is one of the key investigators over 18 years ago working with the indigenous population to hold Exxon accountable, but it wasn't to be. And 20 years later, the devastation of the spill is still being felt, and Exxon has been virtually let off the hook. Joining us to talk about Exxon is Greg Palast. He's the author, among other things, of Armed Madhouse and the editor of gregpalast.com. He reports for the BBC. Greg, it is good to have you back with us.
Always, Dennis. Always glad to be with you.
Well, let's go back to the, let's shoot back to the beginning. Right up top there, Exxon Valdez said the first thing was it wasn't going to be a big problem because the good weather and good conditions essentially wiped the spill away.
Oh, yeah, Mother Nature took care of it all. According to the lazy, well, I won't use the word, the lazy something reporters who don't go up to the Prince William Sound to look at the oil. If they did, you know, kick over rocks over near Chinega on Sleepy Bay, and it still smells like a gas station. It's 20 years later, man. If the damage is still there, Mother Nature doesn't wipe your poop for you so easily, especially with the geology of Alaska. And the evil crime, it's like, it's kind of ecological Holocaust denial. Exxon just says it doesn't exist. Mother Nature cleaned it up. That's it. If you go to gregpalast.com, you'll in fact see masses of oil cleanup being done by guys in yellow suits. Those are natives, local natives cleaning up their beaches in hazmat suits. Those pictures were taken 7 years after the spill by my BBC crew. And, but, you know, Exxon just said no more cleanups after 7 years just because they didn't want the PR. They figured no one would care anymore. What, the governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin, is going to care about what happens to the natives there? She won't even accept unemployment insurance compensation from the federal government, let alone trying to do something for the people who live in the sludge today.
Let's talk about how bad it was then, why it was so bad and got a lot worse based on Exxon's lack of action and preparedness, and what the devastation is that continues.
Well, first of all, let's start out with their lies. I mean, one of the big stories that always comes out is that there's a captain, a guy named Hazelwood, who is drunk and he ran the boat onto a reef, you know, kind of like a drunk driver at the wheel. That's just complete baloney, Dennis. He was stewed. So was the first mate and the second mate. But they were below deck sleeping it off when the third mate was at the helm. But he's flying the boat, this giant tanker, without the Raycast radar system. Raycast was like the early version of GPS, you know, where you could see even a three-year-old could have taken the tanker through the Valdez Narrows if the radar was on. But it was, at that time, wasn't a $200 GPS. Those things were, at that time, cost millions to build and to operate, train. So Exxon, after the maiden voyage of the ship, just it didn't work, so they kept it off and turned it off, which is against the law, by the way. It's like having no speedometer or something. And so that's why the ship hit the reef. Even then, however, I should note that would not have caused the disaster that we saw. The disaster was caused not only by Exxon's cheaping out on the radar, but even more, by saving millions and millions, even billions of dollars on safety equipment to contain a spill. Tankers hit reefs, they run aground, they spring leaks all the time, Dennis, unfortunately. But that doesn't mean that you end up, you know, sludging and sliming 1,000 miles of coastline. What you do, it's real simple. You put a rubber boom, just a big rubber skirt around the ship and its oil, and then you suck it out with a pump into another ship. Well, Exxon promised that they're going to run the water route, which they didn't have to do. If they're going to take oil by water, that they would leave this rubber skirts, these rubber booms out all over the Sound, including right at the place where they hit Bligh Reef, you know, named after Captain Bligh. They were actually supposed to keep equipment right there at the native village, and where if the tanker ever hit there, they could just surround it with the rubber skirt. So it should have been nothing. But there was no rubber skirt there, and there was no ship to suck out the extra stuff that's called a containment ship, because Exxon, despite saying they would never run a tanker without the containment vessel nearby, they ran it anyway, even though the containment vessel was out of commission. It was in a dry dock, and the stuff was locked under ice, the pumps. So you had no radar. Once a ship hit, they had no rubber to contain the oil, which is simple stuff, but they didn't do it because they figured, well, who's it going to check for equipment out in the Prince William Sound except natives, right? They didn't have the ship ready to go, the emergency containment ship. And so you added those things together, and I got to tell you, that's your disaster, but even worse, and here's the ugly, ugly thing, Dennis, it was a crime, and I don't mean that, that's not a metaphor. Before I was a journalist, I was a racketeering investigator. This is criminal activity, I'm not kidding, I use that advisedly. In April 1988, according to my investigation, you know, it's a team, I'll give credit to many people on this, we found memos 10 months before the spill in which Exxon and the oil company chiefs, their chief guy in Alaska, a guy named Theodore Polasek, wrote the chief of Exxon and the chief of British Petroleum, which is their partner, Arco Petroleum, part of British Petroleum, and said, we don't have the equipment that we need that's basically required by law in case there's a spill in the Prince William Sound. And Arco said, well, then if that's the law, they're British, they say, okay, well, I guess you got to comply. And Exxon vetoed it. Exxon adamantly vetoed spending the money to put out equipment required by law. So what their guys did is they simply signed papers saying the equipment was there. This was the top guys. This is, you're talking the presidents and CEOs of the oil companies meeting in Arizona, April 1988, 10 months before the spill, saying, forget it, we're not going to have any spill equipment up there. 10 months later, the spill happened. That's like, has racketeering conspiracy written all over it, Dennis. All over it.
We're speaking with Greg Palast. We're talking about the 20th anniversary, if you will, of the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska that destroyed hundreds of miles of the Alaska coastline and really went a long way to destroy a way of life. Greg, I guess tomorrow's the 20th anniversary. People are still being devastated and undermined by this action. Who was hurt? Tell us about the people you met and who was hurt on this kind of spell, and who is still being hurt?
I actually worked for the Chugach Native Alaskans who, you know, this is native land. It's their islands and their beaches that were destroyed. But you have to understand, it wasn't just, you know, you're not talking about Malibu, where there was, by the way, a spill. We're not talking about, gee, your summer house. These people have lived there for 3,000 years. They're the last people in America to actually survive off the land and where they live. And they lived off seal, they lived off clams that they got, deer, etc. It was all poisoned, destroyed. The seals were of course, poisoned and died. One native elder, Henry McCarka, was telling me about an otter who just, he watched an otter just burn his eyes and bring a hive kite and gouge out its own burning eyes. You know, the deer would eat the poison vegetation and die. Eagles were dying because they were eating the poisoned salmon. It was devastation. And when the president of Exxon came for a photo op to the village saying, we're going to take care of everything, Paul Komkoff, a native seal hunter, said, you know, I'm hungry. You guys are dropping McDonald's foods from helicopters. What is that? I mean, where's my seal meat? So they sent in canned seal meat, which was marked not fit for human consumption because it was zoo food. And, you know, these villages have never recovered because the poison was there for years and years and years. Some of the natives were also commercial fishermen. And, of course, who wants, you know, 90-octane salmon? So they went bankrupt. They lost their boats. And Exxon has refused to pay after 20 years. And there was a court judgment against them, $5 billion, which was supposed to go to 30,000 people. And the Supreme Court this past year, the Bush court, John Roberts, said, well, you know, why are you picking on Exxon, and cut it by 90%? So now, after 20 years, people are getting finally their checks, 10 cents on the dollar. So welcome to corporate America. And the president of Exxon, by the way, retired, that was in charge of this fraud, really, received a $400 million bonus on his retirement. I mean, that, everyone's shaking about AIG. That's twice of all the AIG bonuses combined.
And this treachery by Exxon was premeditated and quite conscious in terms of its brutality all the way through.
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand. It's not that they said, oh, let's have a spill. What they said is, we can save. See, that's the whole thing. This is a profit center. To maintain spill equipment, emergency response teams. They used to hire their natives to go with the tankers because they knew the waters. And they were trained to deal with spills. They had a lot of technical expertise. They knew the waters. They fired all the natives. They got rid of the equipment. They didn't have the containment barges. They refused to have double-hulled boats, which would have also prevented the damage. They saved billions. They saved billions. And when they even had, they would lobby their way out of laws like double-hulled tankers. But even when the law said, they made promises under oath, the top guys at Exxon and British Petroleum and its ARCO unit swore. You're talking about the chairman and CEOs and presidents swore to Congress under oath that they would have spill equipment, that they would maintain the state-of-the-art radar. That was under oath. And they had state-of-the-art radar, but it was off. You know, so, yes, it was, what was premeditated was the penny pinching, or billions of pennies, of course, billions of penny pinching operations, which led to the disaster, and they didn't care, because it was like, to them, it's the cost, what they ultimately paid, now there's 10 cents on the dollar payoff, that's like a license to pollute. As far as they're concerned, it's a license to pollute. If after 20 years, hey, we pay a few bucks. They even told me, Otto Harrison, and I want you to remember his name, because I like to name these people, it's not just an empty corporation, general manager of Exxon USA, said, hey, you know, we'll outlive you. And they did. Paul Komkoff, the seal hunter, is dead. What's the point of giving him a check now?
Outlive them, huh? Outlive the victim and celebrate your retirement on the backs of entire communities. It does sound like corporate life as usual. Is there any way, is there anything to do, or is this now, as they say, dirty water under the bridge?
Well, a couple things. One, Mr. Obama, he got maneuvered into agreeing to some new offshore drilling, expanded offshore drilling during the McCain-Palin oil panic, you know, drill baby drill, okay? And Obama said, okay, well, we'll open up some more coastal waters to drilling, supposedly because we have new safeguards. Well, we heard about those safeguards before the Exxon Valdez. All the safeguards were there. They lie. They still lie. I mean, I just came back from Ecuador, where Chevron Texaco's pooped all over the Amazon. Please just look at Louisiana. I mean, my God, you know, I mean, yeah, they know how to prevent oil spills. They know how to prevent oil pollution, just that it costs money, and they're not going to spend it ever. Forget it. It won't happen. You know, and they'll never enforce the law, because the other aspect of this, and this is not a side issue. As a senator, Obama was a supporter of so-called tort reform, you know, preventing people from filing class action lawsuits, the evil lawyers. Well, you know, I got those documents, I have to tell you. I got those documents about the secret meeting of Exxon and the other oil chiefs before the spill through the legal process, through the Natives lawsuit. They were seeking justice. They were seeking compensation, and we forced Exxon to open its files. And, yeah, we didn't get the money for the Natives that they deserved, but we got a lot of the truth. And that's only because of the right to sue, the right to bring class actions. And I'm just afraid that that last route of justice is being shut down by corporate America. And I'm just afraid that Obama is going to give in to this crap, as he did as a senator, that evil lawyers are filing too many lawsuits against corporations. That's nonsense. There's not enough.
I pledge allegiance to the flags of Microsoft and Exxon, and to whichever mega bank AT&T writes checks on. I swell with patriotic pride whene'er I hear them spell MULTINATIONAL. The sovereign nations of this world, we've canceled every one of them. And every race except the French, 'cause it's still fun to make fun of them. The wind is high, the market's bull. Guess that must be the smell of MULTINATIONAL.
From the March 24th issue of Counterpunch Online, writing about the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant partial meltdown, March 28, 1979, here's Harvey Wasserman's People Died at 3 Mile Island. People died at 3 Mile Island, and more are still dying. At the 30th anniversary of America's most infamous industrial accident, we mourn the deaths that accompanied the biggest string of lies ever told in U.S. industrial history. The public was assured there were no radiation releases. That was quickly proved false. The public was then told the releases were controlled and done on purpose to alleviate pressure on the core. Both assertions were false. The public was told the releases were, quote, insignificant, unquote. But the Nuclear Regulatory Commission later told Congress it did not know how much radiation was released at 3 Mile Island or where it went. It still does not know. Using blue sky estimates of how much radiation was released, the government announced that the average doses received by people in the region were safe. But this statement is utterly meaningless. Among other problems, they ignored the likelihood that high doses of concentrated fallout came down heavily on certain specific areas. Official estimates said that the average dose to everyone in the region equaled that of a single chest X-ray. But pregnant women are not X-rayed because it has long been known that a single dose can do catastrophic damage to an embryo or fetus. The public was told there was no melting of the fuel inside the core, but robotic cameras later showed a very substantial portion of the fuel did melt. The public was told there was no danger of an explosion. But there was, as Chernobyl Unit 4 proved 7 years later. The public was told there was no need to evacuate anyone from the area. Governor Richard Thornburgh then evacuated pregnant women and small children. Unfortunately, he sent many of them to nearby Hershey, which was then showered with fallout. Ken speaking here, and if you ate any chocolate in the late 1970s, you might want to give that a thought. Back to the text. In fact, the entire region should have been immediately evacuated. The health physics community knows there is no safe dose of radiation. Not for anyone, but human embryos, fetuses, small children, and old people are especially vulnerable. The public was assured that the government would follow up with meticulous studies of the health impacts of the accident. In fact, the state of Pennsylvania hid the health impacts. They deleted cancers from the public record. They abolished the state's tumor registry. They misrepresented the impacts they could not hide, including an apparent tripling of the infant death rate in nearby Harrisburg. The federal government did nothing to track the health histories of the region's residents. In fact, the most reliable studies were conducted by local residents who went door to door in neighborhoods where the fallout was thought to be worst. Their surveys showed very substantial plagues of cancer, leukemia, birth defects, respiratory problems, hair loss, rashes, lesions, and much more. Researcher Arnie Gunderson, a leading technical expert on nuclear engineering, recently concluded that Three Mile Island's releases were about 100 times higher than the industry and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission claim, in part because the containment leaked. Worse, the NRC used the bogus low release figures from 3 Mile Island to justify decreases in emergency planning and weaker containment design for future reactors. Other scientific studies clearly indicate that normal, quote-unquote, reactor radiation releases of far less magnitude than those at 3 Mile Island have catastrophic impacts on local populations. After the accident, large numbers of central Pennsylvanians suffered skin sores and lesions from the fallout. Many quickly developed large visible tumors, breathing problems, and a metallic taste in their mouths. These are the same symptoms experienced by some of the airmen who dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, and by those who were exposed to nuclear tests in the South Pacific and Nevada. Reproductive rates among the region's cows and horses plummeted. This was a rural area, keep in mind. And horses were not just fun, they were used as farm work animals by the many Amish in the region. In the mid-1980s, the citizens of the three counties surrounding the plant voted by a margin of 3-1 to permanently retire TMI Unit 1, which had been shut when Unit 2 melted. The Reagan administration trashed that vote and reopened the reactor, which still operates. Its owners now seek a license renewal. Some 2,400 area residents have long since filed a class action lawsuit demanding compensation for the plague of death and disease visited upon their families. In the past quarter century, they have been denied access to the federal court system, which claims there was not enough radiation released to do such harm. Three Mile Island's owners did quietly pay out millions of dollars in settlements to area residents whose children were born with genetic damage, among other problems. The payments came in exchange for the victims' silence. The nuclear power industry continues to assert no one was killed at Three Mile Island. However, it refuses to allow an open judicial hearing on the hundreds of cases still pending. And now, the pushers of nuclear renaissance demand massive public subsidies to build yet another generation of reactors. Ironically, like Chernobyl, Three Mile Island Unit 2 was a state-of-the-art reactor. Its official opening came on December 28, 1978. It melted exactly 3 months later. Had it operated longer, the accumulated radiation spewing from its core almost certainly would have been far greater. Meanwhile, the death toll from America's worst industrial catastrophe continues to rise. More than ever, it is shrouded in official lies, and its victims are desecrated by pro-nuke forces hell-bent on repeating the nightmare on an even larger scale. So writes Harvey Wasserman in an article condensed for radio by yours truly. Thanks for listening. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. That was Roy Zimmerman singing Multinational Anthem. Thanks to Dennis Bernstein and Flashpoints.net for the Greg Palast interview. New World Notes can be heard over the air by internet stream, podcast download, or online listening whenever you choose. For more information or to send feedback, please see the blog at http://newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest New England, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and please tune in again next week.
Yes, heaven waits for those who service the Coke machine in hell. MULTINATIONAL.